I'm walking down the path in my garden, and I have a suggestion for you on how you could help with global warming. With a large lawn, I found a simple way of making a big difference. I sold my ride-on mower and bought a top-of-the-range Kress robotic lawnmower. It runs off rechargeable batteries and uses cutting-edge technology to mow and maintain a lawn this size. The petrol mower has gone, and with it, the emissions. I actually don't know why I didn't sell the ride-on sooner. With the Kress robotic lawnmower, the lawn is actually looking better. The tiny grass cuttings fall into the grass roots, helping to fertilize the grass. And the family doesn't have to put up with the noise and fumes from the ride-on. And I've freed up more of my time to spend with them and in the garden. It's an easy step. And you could also be making that change today. Ask for Kress in your local garden machinery dealer. Or visit kress.com.
Gardeners are fuming. Urban ag activists up in arms. Urban agriculture isn't as climate friendly as it seems. These are all quotes from recent headlines responding to a study in the journal Nature Cities published in late January. The study compared the carbon footprints of urban and conventional agriculture and found that urban agriculture, so things like community gardens, allotments, etc., had a carbon footprint that was about 6 times greater than that of conventional agriculture. That's pretty mad, isn't it? But today we're going to take a deeper look at this study and ask ourselves the hard questions. Is grow your own really as green as it seems? And what, if anything, did this study overlook? But that's not all. We're also exploring what wasps are up to now as winter wanes and getting top tips on pruning shrubby hydrangeas. You're listening to Gardening with the RHS with me, Gareth Richards. So to begin, that contentious article. Does gardening and urban agriculture really have 6 times the carbon footprint of conventional agriculture? Here to discuss is the RHS Sustainability Fellow, Chloe Sutcliffe, whose role at the RHS is to help gardeners better understand their environmental impacts. Speaking to my podcast co-host Guy Barter, Chloe began by reminding us exactly what a carbon footprint actually is.
So a carbon footprint is a measure of the amount of carbon dioxide or gases that are considered equivalent to carbon dioxide like methane that is released into the atmosphere as the result of an activity. So a carbon footprint is one kind of environmental footprint. We can take measures of different types of footprints that would have different effects on the environment. So you could also have a water footprint or a nutrient footprint. And carbon footprints specifically increase levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide, which kind of acts like a blanket, trapping an increasing amount of heat from the sun, which is resulting in an energy imbalance on Earth. So that kind of excess of heat energy is leading to a destabilization of the global climate, which is causing an increase in damaging extreme weather events like droughts and wildfires, heat extremes, floods and severe storms.
And so it's a bit surprising that they found conventional agriculture to be less carbon intensive, have a lower carbon footprint, when you think of all the diesel that farms have to use, all the nitrogen fertilizer and the cold stores and the cold chain. What were their reasons for finding it less carbon intensive?
Yeah, I think the key thing to understand here is that they are talking about an average measure. So they've taken, you know, the average carbon footprint of conventional agriculture and they're comparing it to the average carbon footprint that they have calculated from low-tech urban agriculture. And on average, there was a 5 or 6 times higher carbon footprint from urban agriculture. But the main reason there was a big difference is because of economy of scale, effectively. So in a conventional system, the entire focus is to produce food, as much high value food as you possibly can for the lowest possible cost. Whereas in an urban agricultural system, the primary focus may not be food production for a start. And secondarily to that, you have a lot of infrastructure in urban agriculture. So you have a lot more people needing to access the land. You're going to need to have pathways for those people. All of those people might want to have their own shed or their own tools. And those were the kinds of things that caused the urban agricultural carbon footprints on average to be higher.
Then one of the other conclusions that I thought was very interesting was that the root causes of the surprisingly high carbon footprint of urban agriculture in all its forms was that some resources were used that were quite carbon intensive and they didn't last very long. So I think they're probably talking about sheds. They also felt that there was scope to use more recycling and reusing material. So I wondered what you thought of those.
Whenever you have some significant infrastructure like paving slabs for a path or a shed or a greenhouse or anything like that, quite a lot of energy has gone into producing that infrastructure. And in order to offset that energy use, you need to use that infrastructure for a really, really long period of time. But with urban agriculture, often people aren't producing in the same spot for a very long period of time because either they move house, if it's an individual garden, they don't manage to keep the allotment for very long, or the community gardens in particular, which were found to have some of the higher footprints within the sample that they had, often they're on land that doesn't have secure tenure, so people are forced to leave the land when a better use or a more lucrative use for that land comes along, so it gets developed into housing or something like that. And then all of the resources that have been put into setting up that site are not fully used, so the carbon footprint ends up being higher.
The other thing that surprised me was the suggesting that they used recycled materials. In all the allotment gardens that I'm concerned with, they use all sorts of recycled materials. I've seen a gentleman build a shed out of beaten out car panels. I didn't ask where he got the car panels, but I guess there's also other people who use a lot of expensive brand new timber.
Yeah, an interesting thing about the UK sample in this study was that they didn't actually include any UK allotment sites. So the UK sample consisted of just four collective farms, which would be community gardens, and two urban farms. So it may not be very representative of what people are doing in their private gardens or on their allotments. I think we know that often people do put quite a lot of infrastructure in private gardens, things like patios and sheds and so on. But yeah, I agree with you. In allotment sites, generally people do try and reuse things and are always very keen to get secondhand greenhouses or secondhand sheds or whatever they can put to use.
And the other thing that they mentioned was the value of social goods that produced by urban farms, things like community farms, where they affect and improve well-being. And of course, these social goods do actually have a cash value. You can't go and take them to the bank and put them in your account. But nowadays, with the soaring cost of healthcare, mental healthcare, and days off work through illness, whether mental or physical, there is a value to these things, and it can be quite a high cash value, can't it? I was reading about an allotment the other day that claimed it saved £32,000 worth of healthcare for its members.
Yeah, and also there is a high carbon footprint associated with healthcare. So if people are gardening actively, growing their own fruit and veg throughout their life, they're probably going to have better health outcomes than people who've just been much more sedentary and haven't been engaging in kind of outdoor activities, which are known to be particularly good for health, where you're connecting with nature. So they're likely to have a lower carbon footprint from their health services later on in life than somebody who hasn't done that gardening.
So do you think perhaps we should not really worry too much about the food output and concentrate most on the social goods factor when it comes to urban agriculture in its various forms?
I think that it's really important that people can use urban gardening opportunities for producing food, because food provisioning and consumption is a really fundamental aspect of the human experience. So I don't think that from this paper it would be a positive outcome for people to not produce food in urban areas anymore. When we live in urban environments, we're really far removed from food production. Lots of people don't know what food looks like, you know, when it's growing. And we live in these really highly developed urban contexts where we lack connection to nature and we lack knowledge about kind of the social and environmental conditions of our food production. So I think it's something that's so important that people can actually grow their own food and experience what it's like to kind of nurture whatever it might be, a tomato or, you know, some sweet corn or some lettuces from the point where they're a seed, and then take care of them, keep them weeded, you know, stop the pigeons from getting them. And eventually, if you harvest that and then are able to provide that food to your family, that's a really, really meaningful experience for people where they've engaged really fully with the environment and kind of created a process of social interaction through that environmental engagement as well. So I kind of think that even if food production in urban environments has a slightly higher carbon footprint, it's valuable in so many other ways that we definitely shouldn't stop doing it.
And of course, one of the other big problems is waste of food. And it's been found that if you grow food, you're much less inclined to waste it.
Yeah, so this is another thing that the paper didn't really consider, that sometimes when people engage in one kind of activity, there are sort of spillover effects on other aspects of their life. So if we look at food production in urban contexts as a kind of lifestyle activities, that might be displacing other activities that they would otherwise be engaging in and giving them more of an environmental consciousness, which means that they eat more fruit and veg, they waste less, and they also start to think about reducing carbon footprints in other areas of their life.
One of the other interesting things they mentioned was that crops contributed differently to sustainability. So they recommended that people grew tomatoes. Well, I like growing tomatoes and it's a lot of fun to grow tomatoes. But do you think there is a big difference between crops when it comes to sustainability?
I think it all depends on what you're making the comparison with. So if you are making the comparison with a crop that has been air freighted to the UK, that crop's then going to have a very high carbon footprint. Or if you're making the comparison with a fruit or veg that's been kept refrigerated for months, that's also going to have quite a high carbon footprint associated with it. But in general, I don't think people should be selecting crops to grow because of this paper. They shouldn't think, oh, I'm only going to grow tomatoes and I'm not going to grow potatoes anymore. I think people should recognise that food production in urban areas is a way for them to express their identities. It can be a way to obtain food that they wouldn't be able to access from the supermarket. So even if you're producing the crop that's not the most efficient in terms of its carbon footprint, if it means something to you, then that's the main consideration, I think. At the same time, I think the carbon footprint of gardening is probably dwarfed, as the paper actually suggests, by the rest of a person's lifestyle emissions, especially if they do a lot of luxury consumption, you know, having a much bigger car than they really need and do a lot of flying and that kind of thing. So it's important that we kind of focus on the aspects of our lifestyle carbon footprints that we can reduce without compromising our access to fresh food, for example.
I know we've had you on the podcast before to discuss the calculator you're working on that measures gardeners' output or carbon footprint or other kinds of footprint. What have you learned from that research?
I think what I've learned is that it's not just about how accurately we can measure things. It's about working out how we can communicate environmental information to influence people's behaviour in a positive way. So that's one of the things that worries me slightly about some of the news headlines that have been associated with this paper. If gardeners were discouraged from growing fruit and vegetables on the basis of the paper findings, that would be a real shame because there's so many positive additional outputs and benefits from gardening that they and also the local environment in urban contexts would be missing out on. And that's one thing that we're trying to do with the calculator. We're not only going to calculate the footprints of people's gardening activities, but also their handprints. And the handprints are basically something positive that you do for the environment. So that could be around providing some of those ecosystem services through your garden, or it could be around providing for wildlife and providing for insects and other animals. So yeah, it's going to focus on the positives as well as informing people about how they can reduce the negative impact.
I thought that was a brilliant interview. It was so enlightening to kind of look actually underneath the statistics and find out what the real truth is, because it's a complicated picture and just measuring one thing against another doesn't really give you the whole picture. And of course, as Guy says, a big part of your carbon footprint as a gardener can be to do with the materials and the tools that you buy. And lots of us on allotments will, and at home as well, we'll recycle loads of stuff. I've got a shed that is entirely made of old fence panels and bits of things that have been found and cobbled together. And every day when I go to the allotment, I take old plastic bags, I take old plastic takeaway containers to put my harvests in. There's no denying that that is a positive thing compared to buying your plastic wrapped food in the supermarket. And another thing that I really like that Chloe mentioned early on is talking about equipment as well, because the manufacture of equipment, particularly things like power tools, is really carbon heavy. You can't deny that. But why do we all need our own lawnmower? Why do we all need our own strimmer? Why do we, dare I say it, rotavators, for example? You know, I think we need to be prepared to share our tools and equipment. You know, it saves you a lot of money as well. And it's such a positive environmental step to just think a little bit more collectively. Because 99.9% of the time, you're not using that tool. Let someone else use it. Or have the courage to ask your neighbours if you can borrow their power tools. Why not? You know, we're saving money and saving the planet and maybe just making better relationships between gardeners as we do it. But next, we're going to get on to one of the so-called handprints of gardening. Throughout the past year, we've been releasing a series of stories that focus on the life cycles of wasps. You might think this is a strange thing if you've not heard some of the previous ones, but wasps are actually really, really useful garden creatures, and they definitely have a place in our garden ecosystems. So here's Dr. Sarayan Sumner, entomologist and wasp defender, to tell us more.
So the start of spring, for me, is when I see my first queen wasp, and she'll be emerging just after the snowdrops, perhaps just before the daffodils come out. And you'll start to see these large wasps emerging in a rather cumbersome, sleepy state as they emerge from your shed or your attic or the back of your garden where they've been hibernating. And while they've been hibernating, they have lost up to 40% of their fat, of their body weight. And their first job when they come out of hibernation is to have a bit of a sugar feast. So you will see them on flowers, you'll see them feeding off anything sugary that they can find. So if you happen to find a dopey looking queen, then consider giving her a little bit of sugar to help her on those first few days, which are so critical in her life cycle. By feeding on the sugar, she's not only replenishing the lost body weight that her metabolism has used over the long winter of hibernation, but she's also triggering her ovaries to start developing and triggering her brain to instigate nest building. So these wasps will start their nest all on their own. They are single foundresses, and so they are effectively like a solitary insect at this time of year. You might see them building a very small embryonic nest in your shed. They'll be very small little grey balls, not much bigger than a golf ball to start with. And at this time, that queen has to do everything herself. She'll be gathering wood pulp from your fence posts and your sheds, and she'll be chewing that up to make this really thin but very strong paper that becomes the nest. And then she'll lay an egg in each cell, and she'll then have to provision that egg when it hatches into a larva. She'll be provisioning it with prey. So she's a hunter, she's an architect, she's a mother, she's doing everything herself. And it's super risky time for her, because if she gets killed, then of course her nest will completely die and there will be no propagation of her genes. So at this time of year, the queen really needs to avoid getting eaten by birds or washed away in a rainstorm or just simply running out of energy herself. And so at times when we have early springs, a burst of a heat wave early in the spring, that's quite a dangerous cue for the queens, because what triggers these queens to come out of hibernation is temperature, not photoperiods. So if we have a particularly early spring, like a sunny spell in February, for example, these queens will come out of hibernation a little bit early. And if we then have a severe frost later on in March, for example, then it's quite likely that those queens won't survive, because it will just be too cold and they won't be able to find prey to feed their larvae. It's too early to say whether our unpredictable springs are affecting wasp populations. What we do know is that these yellowjacket wasps are very resilient. They're very good at surviving in lots of different kinds of environments. And we know this because they're very successful as invasive species in different parts of the world. For example, in New Zealand, where they grow to enormous sizes and cause quite a lot of ecological damage. But in their native habitats, native environments like the UK, they do seem to be quite good at surviving the changing environment and the changing anthropogenic environment that we're creating around us. And it may well be that by providing new nesting habitats for these insects, like sheltered sheds and our attics, that we're providing much warmer areas for them to grow their nest in. So I think this is the time of year when you might start to notice these small nests in your shed or in your garden. And the main thing is to consider how you can live alongside that nest. So if you've got a small nest inside your tool shed and you know you're going to be going there every day for the next 5 months or over the summer period, then clearly it's not going to be compatible for you to have an enormous full wasp nest in there at that time. But if it is in a place that you think you can tolerate it, or perhaps you can put up a divide and leave an open window so it can fly at the other side of the shed, then that will really benefit you because you will be growing your own set of personal free pest controllers, free pollinators in your garden, and you will be benefiting from the services that they provide over the summer. There's nothing more exciting for me at this time of year than finding a wasp nest in my shed because they're so unchallenging at this time of year. You can go and watch the nest, you can watch the queen, and she's often curled up around the inside of the nest, and she won't have built the envelope over the whole nest yet. So you'll be able to look up and see those beautiful hexagonal cells that she's built and the larvae inside them, and then she'll have her body coiled around that. And you can even see the larvae being fed by her. You can get up quite close. She's not going to fly at you. She's not going to be trying to defend her colony or sting you. So I think this is a very precious time of year because yellowjacket wasps can be observed firsthand by anyone. They are really not a threat, and it's just a beautiful thing to observe.
That was Sarayan Sumner. If you would like to take a deeper look at wasps and all they do, check out her book, Endless Forms. You can find a link in the show notes. And now for our final feature, we're getting into gardening advice. Adrian Thorne, an RHS advisor, is sharing his top tips for pruning shrubby hydrangeas.
Shrubby hydrangeas are the bush hydrangeas that you see in many gardens. They're very popular, they're deciduous, and they'll drop their leaves over winter, and they come in a variety of different species. From the point of view of pruning, it makes sense to divide them into two groups. We've got the first group of hydrangea macrophylla and hydrangea serrata. Now, they are what we know as lace cap and mophead hydrangeas. The mopheads are the ones with the beautiful big round heads of flower that I often associate with my grandparents. Actually, I seem to remember seeing them around a good few decades ago, and they're very popular. They're lovely. They do change colour according to acidity. The lace caps are slightly more intricate. They have a flower head that we call a corymb, so it's got a little cluster of tiny true flowers in the middle. Then the outside, there's a ring of sterile, larger flowers, and it almost looks like a sort of Victorian, what I think of as a Victorian lady's cap. The second group we have are the arborescens and the paniculatas. Now, the paniculatas are lovely hydrangeas. They're big cones of flowers, big panicles, whereas arborescens have lovely pom-pom styles, balls of flower. With the paniculata and the arborescens, we cut those back early in spring. The plant regrows and flowers on that new wood. Whereas with the macrophylla and hydrangea that we'd be cutting back later in spring, just by a little bit, we want to keep lots of the wood that's grown the previous year in order to allow that to flower. Actually, with macrophylla and serrata, the plants can get along quite well without much in the way of pruning. Pruning does help to get the plants to bush out a little and encourages flowering. So that's why we prune both of those two groups. With the paniculata and the arborescens group, we are encouraging it to put on much more new growth because the new growth with those two produces the flowers. So the early spring prune is for hydrangea paniculata and arborescens. We want to do that before growth starts. So for some parts of the country, that needs to be done now. For others, you may have a few weeks left. What we want to do is we want to take those plants back to a solid framework that stays in place almost permanently. So you're going to reduce your hydrangea to around the 25 to 60 centimetre mark, leaving you with a collection of, you know, perhaps not too exciting, woody sticks at this time of year, woody stems. That will then regrow over the spring, early summer, and that's where we'll get our flower on those two plants there. They'll benefit from a mulch now to try and keep the moisture in the soil through the growing period. And some of the arborescens will benefit from staking to hold up the large flower heads as well, especially popular ones such as Annabelle, which is a beautiful plant. The mop head and lace caps, they require very little pruning at all. They just need effectively a dead heading. We leave the flower heads on through winter to provide a little protection from the frost. But thereafter, we come along and we just prune back to the next set of healthy buds, which may just be a case of deadheading the flowers. The lace caps may even have blown off in the winter by this point, so you're just looking at a bare stem. But still, take it back to the next set of buds, because that stops the plant from diverting energy into producing seeds. So this will happen after the risk of frost has passed, so that really depends on your area. Could be quite as late as June in some areas. If you're unsure which type of hydrangea you have, then I'd suggest waiting until after the risk of frost has passed. Just deadhead your plant and then watch to see what comes up. This can allow you to see the flowers and then you can identify what type of plant you are dealing with. RHS members can send in photos to our gardening advice team who will do their best to identify the plant, and that should be all you need to get pruning. Hydrangeas don't like being allowed to dry out, and this year we did see a number of hydrangeas who flowered poorly, possibly due to a lack of water during the spring and summer growing season last year. So it's always worth giving them a good thorough water during any dry periods in the year.
Thanks there to Adrian Thorne. Adrian wrote an article for the RHS magazine on hydrangeas, which you can read if you download the Garden app. Shrubby hydrangeas are something that I kind of didn't really used to like, if I'm honest. I always associated them with windswept seaside gardens, but actually they really do have a place, and there's been lots and lots of breeding. There's more and more colours, and there's more different types available, because the old-fashioned ones are something called a mop head, which is Hydrangea macrophylla, with those big sort of blousy football-shaped flower heads that kind of come in pink, dusky pink, off old pink. But now there's tons and tons of new varieties. They have different forms. You've got lace caps, you've got serrated petals, you've got lots of hydrangea paniculatas as well, which have that more kind of like conical flower heads, and they flower at a slightly different time, a bit more drought tolerant as well. So yeah, there's a whole lot going on in hydrangeas, and I think they're a plant that's well worth planting. Before we go, I wanted to share a few things to get up to in the garden this week. Mowing your lawn, number one. Okay, so if you haven't got your lawnmower out of the shed yet, now's the time to do it. Give it a check over and cut your grass. But I think quite an important thing is to not go in on the lowest setting if it's the first cut. Put it on a high setting, just take the top off, get the grass used to the idea you're going to be cutting it again. Because if you go too low, you'll just scalp it and you'll encourage moss, you'll get bare patches which bring in weeds. But another thing with mowing your lawn at this time of the year is actually maybe don't mow all of it. Maybe now is a good time to start leaving a little bit for wildflowers. So maybe you could mow a pattern into it and leave some areas uncut, particularly if you've got spring bulbs, like if you've got crocuses or daffodils coming up, you know, mow around those and leave a few patches until about midsummer, because then the bulbs will have time to die down and put strength back into the bulb and flower well next year. But you just never know what kind of wildflowers might show their heads too. If you've got shrubs that you've grown for winter stems, things like Cornus alba, now's the time to give them a good old chop. Again, things like willows or coloured stem brambles, you can chop them right down to the base, and that will encourage them to regrow, and that's what will give you the best stem colour next winter. And I'm going to be sowing my tomatoes. I know You might say it's a bit late. Some people sow them in February, but I like to sow them around now, indoors or in a heated propagator, because then I can just prick them out in April and go straight into the greenhouse. And of course, it's time to sow lots and lots of hardy veg, stuff like broad beans, you can get sowing in now, a lot of cabbages, carrots, onions, all sorts of things. So yeah, get out there, get sowing, steal a march on the season. And finally, we want to hear from you. If you're having issues on your allotment or you have general horticultural questions you'd like addressed on the show, send me your queries at podcasts@rhs.org.uk. That's all for now. So from me, Gareth Richards, goodbye and thanks for listening.
I'm walking down the path in my garden and I have a suggestion for you on how you could help with global warming. With a large lawn, I found a simple way of making a big difference. I sold my ride-on mower and bought a top-of-the-range Kress robotic lawnmower. It runs off rechargeable batteries and uses cutting-edge technology to mow and maintain a lawn this size. The petrol mower has gone, and with it, the emissions. I actually don't know why I didn't sell the ride-on sooner. With the Kress robotic lawnmower, the lawn is actually looking better. The tiny grass cuttings fall into the grass roots, helping to fertilise the grass. And the family doesn't have to put up with the noise and fumes from the ride-on. And I've freed up more of my time to spend with them and in the garden. It's an easy step. And you could also be making that change today. Ask for Kress in your local garden machinery dealer. Or visit kress.com.
Discover the beauty of an RHS membership all year round. Save 25% off an RHS membership today when paying by direct debit. Prices start at just £55.50. With a membership, you'll gain access to an array of special events at our gardens all year round. Be the first to know about RHS flower shows and get exclusive member-only days, plus reduced rate tickets. And you'll have the chance to enhance your gardening know-how with access to free expert garden advice, monthly editions of the Garden magazine, and so much more. Terms and conditions apply.